is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hi, this is former NBA player CJ Watson, and you're listening to the Hoop Heads podcast.
Hey, Hoop Heads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoop Heads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoop Heads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
It's not so much like, man, I need a new drill. No, you just need a new way to take that old drill you got and force the players to make decisions out of it.
Corey Harris is currently an assistant basketball coach for the Chinese Basketball Association's Beijing Royal Fighters, under their head coach, former NBA All-Star Stephon Marbury. Corey went to China in August of 2018 and was hired by Marbury to coach with the Royal Fighters in September of 2019. Corey is a certified instructor and camp clinician under Gannon Baker Basketball and has experience teaching at numerous national skill academies, coaching clinics, team camps, pro training camps, and clinics. Corey played college basketball on the JUCO, NCCAA, and NCAA levels and credits his development as a player to the same lessons he teaches on a daily basis to his clients. Corey finished his college career as a second-team NCCAA All-American, first-team All-Region, and first-team All-Conference selection. He tied the Trinity Bible College school record for most assists in a game, 13, and helped lead the school to its first ACCA National Championship appearance and its first season with an undefeated home record in school history. Be sure to register for our Hoopheads Pod webinar series with some of the top minds in the game across all levels, from grassroots to the NBA. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. We've recently dropped two new shows as part of our Hoopheads podcast network, Thrive with Trevor Huffman and Beyond the Ball. Make sure you subscribe and check out both shows on your favorite podcast app. The CoachMaze.com podcast, featuring actionable advice for high school basketball coaches, is coming soon. Please rate and review all our shows on your favorite podcast app. Get ready to be inspired and learn from the journey of Coach Corey Harris, currently an assistant coach with the Beijing Royal Fighters in China. Hello and welcome to the Hoop Heads podcast. It's Mike Lensing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. Tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from the Beijing Royal Fighters skills coach, Corey Harris. Corey, welcome to the podcast.
What's up, Mike? Thanks for having me, man.
We are excited to have you on, dig into the things that you've been able to do thus far in your young basketball career as a coach and go back and talk a little bit about what you learned as a basketball player. And let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Talk to us about how you came to the game of basketball. What made you fall in love with it?
Wow. Great question. For me, it's a little different from most. I started pretty late, and that's because in the South, you know, in the early to mid 90s, basketball wasn't a big deal, especially in Atlanta, Georgia. That's where I'm from originally. Most of us, we played baseball, played football, ran track. So I grew up, you know, playing in the sandlot, playing sports for, you know, little league teams and things of that nature. But there was no courts around us unless you played for, you know, the high school. You didn't really get the chance to see the hardwood. So, of course, we had it on television, but I wasn't really introduced to the game physically until I was probably about 10 or 11 years old. And actually, we had to, you know, climb some fences, cut some holes in some fences in a neighboring neighborhood just to get to the basketball court. And that's when the journey began. You know, I wasn't very good at the time, of course. And I think because I was so naturally good at other sports, but yet basketball was such a challenge to me, I gravitated more towards that. And I began to put down a lot of the other sports because I just love a challenge. I love trying to, you know, figure things out and overcome an obstacle. So even from a young age, I was just hungry to prove people wrong and fell in love with the game probably in like 96, 97.
What was it about basketball beyond the challenge something specific about the game itself that made you say, man, I got to really get after this?
I think it was Kobe. Like I said, 95, 96, around the time he was drafted out of high school, you know, it wasn't like, you know, when LeBron James or, you know, some huge, huge name came into the league, but he was still pretty much a young star that, you know, we all took notice of. And so, like, Michael Jordan was obviously the best player in the game, but I was a little too young to fully understand what he had already accomplished. So to see, you know, a young dude coming out of high school and he's making it to, you know, the Los Angeles Lakers, which is a story franchise, but yet he's, like, struggling and going through it. By the time I was 9, 10, you know, and I'm struggling to pick up the game, and now he's a star in the NBA, I'm thinking, like, okay, I'm Kobe Bryant. Like, I was almost trying to mimic and parallel, like, his NBA career and, like, my young, you know, adolescence. So, of course, you know, you have your childhood heroes, your Ken Griffey Jr.'s, Barry Sanders, you know, guys like that. But it was something different about Kobe. It was, like, the fact that he wasn't wearing a football helmet or he wasn't, you know, muted the way some other athletes are because their sport, the camera's not in their face, or you don't get to see them up close and personal the way you do with basketball. It's only five guys on the court at a time. So even the ratio of players in front of the camera is different. It, I don't know. I just felt like I wanted to be him. So I met another guy by the name of Corey Harris. Crazy story. He was the starting point guard at the neighborhood high school, Osborne High School. And he was a pretty good player, and he lived in my apartment complex and in our project. And, you know, he put a ball in my hands for the first time, him and another guy named Brian Elmore. And so, you know, just from them showing me how to dribble or showing me how to shoot or teaching me how to make my first layup on a 10-foot rim, you know, double rim, that was like all I needed. You know, it was like the first time I had ever been coached, so to speak. So that was it for me.
So how much fun was it for you when you look back on those early years, having an opportunity to play basketball outside, which today kids just don't get an opportunity to do simply because in a lot of cases there isn't courts available to them. And if there are, chances are there aren't that many people playing on those courts.
Right.
So what was it like for you growing up with outdoor basketball?
Oh, man, I don't really know what it's like to not have it, you know, so it's kind of awkward for me when I talk to kids and they don't relate, you know, in that way.
Absolutely.
Like you always have to try to fix your brain when you're dealing with players, whether they're, you know, professionals nowadays or, you know, you're training a kid. You can't approach them with that same kind of like grit, you know. Some of them, they have it, but you have to manufacture it in different ways. For me, it maybe in the middle of the games, it didn't feel fun because it was just so intense, but like you always looked forward to it. And I think it was, you knew you couldn't get on the court, you know, at certain times because that's when the grown men were playing. Like, I grew up in an apartment complex, like a project. So we had hundreds of kids, you know, in elementary, middle, and high school that all live in our same, you know, area. And so from maybe 10 a.m. to 12 on a Saturday or Sunday morning, you know, you could not get on that court. You had to just sit against the chain fence and you had to just watch the older guys play. And if you were young and you were good enough to get on the court, then, you know, maybe they would allow you to play. But you kind of built a determination, you know, playing 21 games with 15 kids on one half court, you know, like, or, you know, playing knockout, you know, gotcha. You're shooting and it's 20 people in a line, you know, or you got to write your name on the ball because someone will just steal your ball, you know, just walk off with it, you know, or you got to fight after a game. Even though you won, they still trying to put you off the court because they're upset and they don't want to get off. So, like, all those situations, they didn't seem fun in the moment, but it did make the game fun because it gave you something to play for. And I feel like kids just need that. That's how we have to manufacture that same experience now. Like, give them a reason to play every time they get on the court. Maybe it's pride. Maybe it's representing your cul-de-sac or, you know, whatever it is. But I feel like I represented my neighborhood every time I played or every time, you know, I stepped foot on the floor.
How old were you when you cracked the main run for the first time?
Oh, man, it wasn't quick. It took me years. I think I was probably in high school by the time I was allowed to play because we had moved. We lived in that apartment complex. So I was maybe in eighth grade. It got really dangerous. My mother just wanted us to get out of that community. And so I went to a neighboring high school, you know, up the road in another city called McEachern High School. And when we got to that area, you know, I found another outdoor run. You know, this time I was playing in what's called Hurt Road Park. The Atlanta Hawks, they you know, laid some cement and they paved it and, you know, made it flat. And they kind of christened the park before we had moved there. But it was like a famous park in that area. And so I think I was maybe a sophomore, you know, maybe 16 years old. And I had one good run on a Sunday, like 12 noon. Everybody's parked out in the grass, barbecuing, you know, music blaring. And they needed an extra one. And so they just asked me to get on the court. And, you know, you had to take your shirt off because they were skins. And they just – they weren't giving me the ball. You know what I mean? They definitely weren't giving me the ball. But I was picking up full court, you know, just trying to do what I could, you know, trying not to get cussed out. And I think I came up on a couple steals. Like, you know, the guy I was playing, he probably was tired or something. I don't know. He probably smoked and drank in between games. But caught him slipping, got a few steals, got a layup. And, you know, my teammates hyped me up, and I couldn't get off the court after that. Every time, you know, either we lost or, you know, somebody else needed a five and I came on the court, my nickname was Slim. And they said, Slim's going to pick up full court. Slim's going to bring the ball up and down the court. He's the point guard. But, you know, Slim, you just stand in the corner, you know. So I had to earn everything, even on that court, you know.
So that is awesome. I love, yeah. So here's a quick, I got a couple questions for you. I love playground basketball. Sure. I grew up in the same sort of fashion in terms of just always going and playing outdoor pickup basketball. And I think that when right. I go back and look at my time playing, I always say that playing outdoor basketball with people of all different ages and backgrounds did so much for me as a basketball player. I mean, you were talking about how your nickname was Slim, and I could just mm-hmm. I could see all those older players just point yeah. me out and having no idea what your real name was, and just being like, "Hey, Slim, man, go over there and do this and do
right.
that." And
right. Right.
I just think back to my time when I was playing. My nickname, there was a guy I started playing maybe when I was 13 or 14. Like, I'd be the first guy that would get up to the court so that I could try to get in that very first game and then maybe get a chance to stay on
for
the floor.
Sure.
But my nickname was West. I had a guy that started calling me Jerry West. And so anybody who knows me from that era of my life, and now that era of my life is, you know, 34 some odd years ago. So it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But there's people that know me from that era, and I'll see them, and nobody else in my current life really even knows that.
I didn't know that, Mike.
You didn't know that?
So,
all right,
so I did not know this. So this is after doing 300 some episodes, I thought I pretty much knew everything about you, Mike.
So all right, well, good. This is good. So anyway, so it's funny because I'll still see some of those people. I'll run into them and they'll be like, "Hey, West," and then there'll be people,
West.
And there'll be people who are with me at the time who are from my current life, and they're looking at me like I'm crazy. They're like, "Who are they talking to? What do they even mean?" But that resonated so much with me when you said, "Hey, Slim, go in the corner," because I can still yeah. remember people saying, "Hey, Wes, just go over here and do this and, you know, do that." So pick up basketball was just – it was phenomenal. So if you look at that time in your life and your development as a player, what's something that you got out of pickup basketball and playing mm-hmm. outside on the playground that – you might not have been able to pick up if you had grown up on the AAU circuit the way a lot of kids grow up on the AAU yeah. circuit today? What's something that's different maybe that you got from AAU than what a kid might get from the AAU circuit today?
I think it was just more of a respect for the progress, like the process you have to go through as a player. You know, you don't just step on the court and, oh, everybody gets a turn to play. You know, everybody gets – you know, equal playing time, or if your parents can afford to, you know, pay the fee for you to go on the AAU circuit, then you get a jersey. You know, there was a lot of days of going out to the Hurt Road Park or my neighborhood, you know, court. It was a converted tennis court, and they just, like, you know, dropped some poles into the ground at the ends of the tennis court, and we ripped up the net in the middle and threw it in the woods. But, like, that you went to that court a lot of days as a kid not knowing if you were going to get to even shoot, you know. So if you had a ball, you might be able to dribble, you know, in the grass outside of the chain fence, or you might be able to lean against the fence and maybe shoot if they went to the other side of the court for a little bit. But, you know, you really understood, like, I got to earn the chance to play with these guys. And so once I got to college and, you know, got the chance to play, it wasn't as hard for me to stay at a school and not try to just, like, transfer or play the blame game, you know, when my coaches didn't like me or didn't like my game or were a little critical of me. It wasn't hard for me to understand that, you know, there was a pecking order with my teammates. You know, I played with a player of the year, you know, my junior year, and a lot of guys could never do that and still keep their pride. You know what I mean? They probably wouldn't feel too comfortable in his space as a player, because you feel like, you know, he's going to get the majority of shots, the majority of the minutes. If he makes a mistake, you know, we probably don't have the time to yell at him, cuss him out. But as soon as you make a mistake, it's coming down on you. Those are just things that, you know, when you have to work for something and no one's telling you the rules, they're just like unspoken rules. I think it makes a lot more sense to you. It's not taught. Like, I didn't sit in a classroom and have someone tell me 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You just kind of picked it up. And kids nowadays, they can still learn those lessons, but again, it just has to be manufactured in a different way.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's a great way of looking at it, manufactured versus sort of an organic way of learning those things, where you're like, hey, you better play your role. If you're one of those guys who's a fringe player on the playground who maybe shouldn't be out on the court, or maybe you're young and whatever, and boy, if I don't play defense and pass the ball to the guy who's the big scorer on my team, if I start taking a lot of bad shots, I can be pretty sure that I'm not going to get picked up for the next game. And you said, those are lessons that you learn on the playground that you just don't learn on the AAU circuit, unless, as you said, unless those are manufactured and the coach is working with you and teammates and parents and trying to get you to understand your role and all those kinds of things. I think in pickup basketball, that stuff just kind of happens naturally. When you go back to those courts today, are people still playing out on the courts that you grew up on?
Oh, man. Well, the one apartment complex where I grew up, you know, they tore those rims down a lot of times because of, you know, violence or just different things that would occur that they felt was a black spot, you know, in the community. And so it's funny, I didn't mention it before, but we would put milk crates on the fence. Like, we would steal Coca-Cola crates from the delivery truck at the neighboring high school. And we like melted the bottom of it out with a lighter, and we would stomp out the bottom of the crate. And so we would use clothes hangers and hang it up. But, you know, the kids probably who came after us, you know, once we got older, I don't think they loved the game that much. You know, they probably did other things to figure out ways to have fun. So I think I visited there maybe 2 years ago just to see what that neighborhood was like. I was in between my time here in China and my last little, I think I was maybe in the States for 2 or 3 months, and I just needed to see like where I came from one day. I wanted to inspire myself, and I didn't see anyone outside. It was kind of discouraging, but Hurt Road is definitely always jumping. If the sun is out, you know, people are out there doing their thing and playing. I bump into those guys that we used to play with now at like the grocery store. You know, they're a little older now. They don't have the knees and the joints, you know, to get up and down. But anytime they see me, it's just like your story. You know, what's up, Slim? People look at me weird. Like,
hey, they have a lot in common with Mike. They don't have the knees anymore.
That's right. That's awesome. That is so cool, though. That's awesome that people are still playing at the park. And it's cool that it's so much fun to run into people from different eras and different times of your life. It's just, you know, it's one of those things that basketball does so well. It just connects people of all different races, genders, ages, communities.
Sure.
And that's one of the things that's so great about the game of basketball. Let's talk a little bit about your high school career. So obviously you start out, you're a little bit behind other people because you get a late start in the game. So just talk about how you developed yourself into the type of player, and then maybe give us a highlight or two from your high school career.
Sure. So this is the ultimate story of development, and it's going to be weird. So just kind of fasten your seatbelt and hang.
We're ready.
So,
we're ready.
So eighth grade, I get my first opportunity to play on an AAU circuit. I had like a little part-time job when I was in eighth grade just to help my mother out. And I would work with a summer camp, you know, program at one of the neighboring communities. And so it was for like at-risk youth, and different people would come in and volunteer their time, but I was on staff. And so for maybe a summer, we had a coach who previously lived in New York, and he was an AAU coach from the Gauchos, you know, the famous AAU organization, and his name was John Walker. So he came and, you know, he looked me up and down. He said, you know, you look like a point guard, man. Like, you know, where do you play? And I said, well, I don't play anywhere. You know, I don't think I'm good enough. And he said, you know, nonsense. So he would take a group of us, you know, to the gym, and he would just kind of teach us, work us out a little bit. But we didn't know he was plotting on starting like a Atlanta chapter of the Gauchos. And so, you know, he really liked my game, and he took us to like this kind of round robin tournament, you know, in downtown Atlanta. And this thing was like, you know, just bare knuckles, like no blood, no foul. Like some of the referees were, I don't know, maybe parents from the crowd, you know, that they just gave like a shirt, you know, with some stripes on it and gave them a whistle. But, you know, somehow this thing was sanctioned and we were, you know, really playing real games. And I was playing pretty well. You know, this was my actually my first time playing like real organized basketball. And he didn't know that because I was too afraid to tell him. I thought it would, you know, make him, you know, a little weary, you know, of putting me on his team. But when I finally told him after the first two games, it actually made him a lot more willing to work with me because he thought I had a lot of raw talent. And he thought that was great that I didn't have any like habits that maybe have been inserted from another coach. It was just bad habits from playing in the streets. He could work with that. So our third game, we played three games in one day. Third game, I'm going for a layup on a fast break, and a kid just like, I don't know why he thought he was going to chase down block it, but he tries to go LeBron and like pin it off the glass. I make the lay and I'm still like coming down, and we both just flip over into like a row of bleachers and chairs, right? We're just rolling into all the chairs. Feels like I can't stop. I try to get up and my left arm has like a compound fracture in both like my upper arm as well as my forearm. And so, you know, I feel like my arm's okay. So I try to put my hand on the ground and press to get up. And, you know, obviously it gave. And so that was it for, you know, a good couple of months. I was done. But he kept in contact with me. And so he would take me to the gym, work me out, and I would develop, you know, my opposite hand. And I taught myself how to shoot with my other hand because I'm naturally left-handed. So I taught myself to shoot with my right. And he was like, well, I'm going to call a coach, and I want – your mother to be by the phone because this could be big for you. So a coach calls me from, I think, Destin, Florida, or Orlando, Florida. I can't remember anymore, but he had some type of basketball academy where kids from around the country would come and basically like live there and just eat, sleep, breathe basketball 24/7. And then they will put you in a school, you know, and it would just continue to develop your game. Kind of like how IMG is nowadays, but this was back in the early 2000s before that was like a big thing. So coach calls, my mom flips on this coach, man. She's like the helicopter mom of all time. You know, like, what? You think I'm going to send my baby all the way to, you know, God knows where? I don't know you. Like, who do you think you are? Like, no, hangs up the phone, bam, in his face. I'm crying. Like, I'm like, yo, I was going to the NBA, mom. You just killed it. Like, it's over now. Like, I'm going to be working at McDonald's, you know. So I didn't play. And I went to go try out, you know, for my new high school, like their feeder program, their eighth grade team, didn't make the team because, you know, I just didn't really know the game. I was still just a street ball player. And so by the time I got to ninth grade and I was in high school, my skills were severely lacking and my IQ was severely lacking. So, like I said, this is a wild story. I actually didn't play high school basketball at all. Through my 4 years of high school, I tried out every year, made it to the last cut every year. And I had Josh Smith, who ended up playing for the Atlanta Hawks, Morris Allman, who made it to the Utah Jazz. He was the leading scorer in the nation at Rice University. We had, you know, a bunch of Division I players who eventually played overseas, you know, that I'm still friends with to this day. But those guys were formidable players, real players. And it didn't matter that I had heart. It didn't matter that I had, you know, hunger and that I was fearless. When you don't understand a game, like you cannot compete with someone who does. So I never really blamed my coach. I never blamed, you know, anyone. I just kind of took it on the chin and I just kept working. And once I graduated high school, then I tried to set my sights on, well, if I have to play my very first game of organized basketball in college, I'm going to do it. And so, like I said, it's a wild story, but I ended up playing 5 years of college basketball, and I was eventually a second-team All-American my senior year. We played in a national championship game and lost my junior year. It's wild, but I couldn't script it out, you know, if someone asked me to. I couldn't write a story like that.
Absolutely not. So how does the opportunity, after not having played high school basketball, obviously some things have to go your way in order for you to be able to get an opportunity to play in college. So talk about how that opportunity came to pass.
For sure. So I didn't understand the college game and like the differences between Division I, Division II, Division III. I didn't understand that there was even, you know, a JUCO route that you could take. I didn't know anything about NAIA basketball. There's an ACCA level, NCCAA, you know, Christian college basketball. I didn't know any of those things. So all I knew is I had a NCAA hoops, like 2K hoops, the video game. So I was like, man, I'm gonna find a school on here. I'm playing the game, like, you know, every day after school in high school, and I'm thinking, Hofstra University, you know, who's that? You know, so I look it up. Speedy Claxton was on the Atlanta Hawks. He was like a backup point guard at the time, and he was 6 feet tall, you know. So I thought to myself, like, okay, let me find out more about Speedy. And, you know, I saw that that's where he went, Hofstra, and I was like, man, I can do that. You know what I'm saying? I can figure that out. You know, I can play. So I put in an application, even though I'm getting scholarship opportunities because of my academics from a bunch of other schools. I just go ahead and set my sights on Hofstra, you know, and I told my mom I wanted to be a engineering major, you know, that I wanted to go to New York. She said, that's fine. And, you know, as long as I understood what I was getting myself into, she would support me. She didn't know anything about, you know, the college process, so she was just kind of taking my lead. I don't know if – I can't remember if it was Jay Wright who was the head coach at the time, but, you know, they had a pretty successful program then within the Colonial Conference. And I just began calling the coaches every single day. That's back when you could find all their contact info on the athletic website. So, you know, from the head coach all the way down to the, you know, grad assistants, I was emailing, calling them. I even went and like tried to put some film together playing in like a men's league, you know, that time around the end of my senior year, you know, and I still have those DVDs. I paid like $200-$300 and, you know, sent it to this guy who was like a professional video editor or whatever he called himself. And man, it was the worst film I've ever seen. Like, this is not Baller's Life, Hoop Mixtape, anything worthy. Like, it was terrible, but I took that and I tried to make it look as professional as possible as far as, you know, all my info is on there, my grade, point average, my desired major, all that stuff. I did the research, you know. And so I sent that to the coach. And I think the coach just, the assistant at the time, he just felt sorry for me. He recognized my hunger. And so he finally picked up his phone one day after like a month of leaving messages every morning at 8:15. 8:15, I would call every morning. And even his personal assistant knew me by name. Like, when she would see my number go across, she would just say, Corey, he's not in. Like, you know, it was, we developed a relationship. But one day he finally picked up the phone and he said, look, we can give you an opportunity for a preferred walk-on spot. You know, we can't promise you anything. You know, I see that you're, you know, barely 6 feet tall. You know, the Division I level is tough. But, you know, if you can get here as a student, then obviously, you know, you'll be in the building to have the chance to try out. So I go to New York, you know, first semester starts. I'm living out the student life and I'm just patiently waiting for that day. And again, still, like, you got to understand, I've only been training myself. I've been working out on my own. I've just been playing in the street or playing in the rec centers. I still don't have an understanding of the game, you know. So I get to walk-on trials finally, and, man, I get torched. Like, I'm talking, why is he here? You know, like, Charles Jenkins, who was a freshman point guard at the time, he had just gotten to Hofstra as well. He eventually got drafted 4 years later by the Golden State Warriors and dropped like 30 something points in his first, you know, NBA appearance. You know, so he's there as a freshman. He looks like, you know, Eric Bledsoe at 18. Like, it's, if you can imagine just the physical stature of a 6'2", 6'3 point guard with a full beard and a ball spot in his head. Like, why is he out here? You know, check his birth certificate. There's no way this dude is a freshman. But, you know, it was just like I was swimming in the ocean without a life jacket. That's what it felt like. It felt like I was gasping for breath every time we were doing something that required me to think like a point guard. I was in shape, but I just couldn't handle full court pressure. I couldn't, you know, get the offense set. I couldn't initiate an action. I couldn't get to a spot to get off a sideline pick and roll. I couldn't get you the ball on the low block, even if you had your guy sealed completely behind you. Couldn't make an open shot. you know, all of those things that you just naturally learn how to do by being put in those scenarios time and time again, I either didn't have the confidence to do it or I just had never done it. So the answer was no. You know, obviously coaches, you know, they were very gracious to me and I still appreciate them to this day for that. But that discouraged me very greatly. And so once I walked out of that gym, you know, admittedly, just being honest, telling you guys the truth, like I felt like I had no reason to be in school anymore. And it led to me making some bad decisions as far as how I was spending my free time, going to class, attendance, you know, just being a young man. Like I built my life around becoming a basketball player instead of being a good person. And so when that was taken away from me, I didn't have a leg to stand on. And I bombed out. I actually got, you know, kicked out of the school. I was asked to leave, you know, amongst other things. And my mother had to drive all the way from Atlanta, Georgia to pick me up in Long Island, New York, New Hempstead, New York, 20-something hour drive. And the longest drive of my life. My mother didn't speak to me once. And, you know, we're close. She's always been, you know, my number one fan, cheerleader, supporter, everything. So it crushed me. And when I got home, I made the decision that I wasn't going to allow other kids to make the same bad decisions of not understanding what it takes to be a good person, a good man, a good woman, and then a good basketball player. And so I just started a business. I started a company. I formed an LLC called Student of the Game Training Co. I started, you know, coaching within the young, like YMCA and recreational basketball leagues in my area, you know, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds. And that allowed me to learn the game as they learned the game. You know what I mean? Because in order to teach, you have to be able to, you know, first learn. And so I spent a lot of times just in coaching clinics or in high school practices or watching tapes or just going to games. And I wasn't a fan of the game anymore. I really became that student of the game. And 5 years passed. I was paying back my debt to the University of Hofstra. And it was about $40,000. And, you know, paying that back over the time, it kind of set my sights more towards business, but the love of the game never left. And so I got the opportunity to play again through a guy. I was training his daughter. His name is Lonnie Edwards. And I used to have to drive an hour and a half across the city, you know, on Thursdays to go and train her. She's a really good player, and I appreciated, you know, their business and the opportunity to work with him. And he looked at me one day. He said, "Man, you look like you still got a lot of gas left in the tank." And he called me Slim. He didn't know anything about my street ball days, but he called me Slim when he said that.
That's awesome.
And when he said that, Mike, it touched a part of my heart that hadn't been touched in a long time. And it was like someone saw me again as a player. I had become Coach Corey, you know, in the eyes of local high school players or middle school, you know, whatever level. But when Lonnie called me, you know, "Man, Slim, you look like you can still play." And he's just speaking slang. He's just, you know, just talking. But it reminded me of something that I really wanted and I desired and I needed it. And I knew I could never really be a good coach if I at least didn't have the experience that my players went through. I got tired of reading articles and watching documentaries and using those as object lessons, you know, in my training session. I got tired of like having to relate what my players were dealing with like, you know, struggling to understand what their coach needs from them or lack of playing time or struggling to earn more playing. Like I got tired of having to go and find other people's stories. And so I knew I needed to play. I just knew I wasn't going to ever like rise to a certain level if I didn't have the experience. So when he said that, I was immediately wide-eyed and ready to listen. And he actually called two coaches. He called Tony Markopoulos from Cabrillo College in Santa Cruz, California. And he called another coach in South Georgia. The one in South Georgia didn't work out. And, you know, I wanted to go there because obviously it was closer to home. But I'm so blessed and I'm so grateful that it worked out for me to go to California. Coach Tony was an a-hole in every sense of the word. And I don't care if he's listening now, he knows that. But he would love for me to say that. You know, he's a very honest guy. You know, it's no BS. Like, he's in your face, you know, spit flying, and he'll throw stuff and whatever he got to do to get through to you, you know, he's down for it. So I was down for it. And that year was the toughest year of my life, playing junior college basketball in a very fast-paced league like in California, where you had, you know, NBA, future NBA players and all types of, you know, scouts and people just all around you putting that pressure on you to succeed. But, you know, it taught me again how to go from being at the end of the bench. You know, I was beyond the end of the bench. Like, I probably sat beside the water cooler. Like, I was probably detached from the bench. You know, people probably didn't even know I was on the team. But I went from there to, you know, earning a little time, dealt with an injury, bounced back from that, met great people, developed thicker skin, and learned the fundamentals of the game just through practicing. You know, I was pretty much a practice guy. And a four-year school, you know, that I had a mutual friend with, they needed a point guard called Crossroads College. They were really struggling at the time, and they kind of liked my attitude, and they brought me in for a workout in Rochester, Minnesota that summer. And so I did really well there, and I was the team captain the next year. But just started on a journey. So I was at Crossroads for 2 years. We broke school history, made school history. I went undefeated at home my second year there. First time school had been ranked in the NCCAA. It was a Christian college. And we were one of the best teams in the nation. We lost in, I think, like the Sweet 16 of the national tournament. School closed down after my second year because of lack of funding and all types of things. So I didn't know where I was going to go. And right before the deadline passed to get back into school again and be able to play, Jordan Noel, a coach from Trinity Bible College, gave me a call out of the blue and offered me the chance to come and be his point guard the next year. He had some film, and I forgot we had even played them, but I had given them a triple-double. So he was like, man, I still remember. Like, you gave my guard nightmares. So I came over there and broke their assist record. We went to a national championship my junior year. It was the first time the school had reached one. And then my second year, you know, I went on to be a second team All-American All-Conference. And I just had a wild ride, but, you know, I never cut any corners, Mike. I never made excuses. I never asked for anything from someone else that I wouldn't do myself. I cried real tears, you know, after my senior night. Mother wasn't there. No one that, you know, I felt that actually was a part of my journey, you know, from start to end, could see it at the end, but it was still beautiful in its own way. You know, I'm thankful for it. And it prepared me for what I'm doing now, which is to work with people who actually love the game to the point where they'll sacrifice, you know, just to become a professional. You know, I felt like I always was going to be that. I just maybe started too late, or I didn't have the resources to do so, but that's my journey.
That is a fantastic journey. It really is. And I want to pull out a couple things that, as you were going through it, there's a couple of things that stood out to me. And one was right from the very beginning, and you kind of glossed over it. But I think it's something that if a player is out there listening or a coach is out there listening, I think it's a story that is relatable. And that is when you talked about the opportunity to go to Hofstra, you talked about the fact that your grades were so important. And you didn't talk very much about having good grades and why that was important, but clearly that had something to do with the opportunities that came to pass for you in college, where if you hadn't have been a good student, those opportunities might not have come. So just talk a little bit about where that focus from academics came from. Did it come from your mom? Did it come from inside of you? A combination of both. Just talk about why the academic side of it was so important and sort of where you ended up and how you went along your journey.
For sure. I think it probably started when I was maybe in like kindergarten, first grade. You know, I had a very tough first couple of years, you know, in just, you know, regular school. Like, my kindergarten teacher, it's funny how you remember the ones that like really either pushed you or really like made life hard for you. But I had a teacher named Miss Jacoby, and I don't know what it was about that old lady, but man, she ain't like me. And, you know, I'm a naturally quiet person in public. So in school, I was pretty quiet. You know, I didn't say a lot. And it wasn't out of like, I just was a good kid. I feared my mother, man. I wasn't trying to have my mom come to the school. I didn't want to, you know, even think about my mom. You know, my mom was like, Jason, if you run, she going to find you. She going to catch up to you, you know, and she's in a slow stroll. Somehow she's right there waiting on you. So I was a good kid in school just for that. And Ms. Jacoby just had it out for me. I remember finishing kindergarten and first grade with her, like all A's, and she still requested that I be held back. And it just kind of threw me. The principal like got involved. It was like a big deal within the school. It turned into like this thing within Bernie Elementary where a lot of parents were questioning pulling their kids out of school. But what my mom did, it actually inspired me even to this day. Like, it stands out, and it's probably why academics are so important. She withdrew me from school, and she decided to homeschool me, even though she had not completed high school herself. You know, so you can only imagine what it's like to be at home as a kid being homeschooled, and your teacher is someone who's learning the curriculum with you. You know, so like, I would listen to my mother like struggle to read certain words and teach herself, you know, definitions and pronunciation. And we did Hooked on Phonics together. We did all type of things together. I wrote book reports, and you know, that was the atmosphere within my home. It was the atmosphere of always learning. You know, we were both students. She got her GED at the same time while, you know, I was at home being homeschooled every day. And she would still have to go to work, and she worked two, three jobs at the time. So there were even days where like I would go through the curriculum. It was called a Becca curriculum. I would go through the math, the English and all that stuff sitting at the dining room table on my own. And, you know, she would come home and check it, of course, but that kind of like, just, I don't know, I won't say I was a loner, but that individualistic mindset where, okay, my mom's doing everything she can to not only teach me this stuff, she's learning it on her own, and she's like supporting us as a single mom. It was like, it created an attitude in me where I can't lose. Like, I can't fail. Failure is not an option. Like, I gotta get this. I gotta go hard. I gotta get all A's. I gotta, you know, do whatever is necessary. But then when I got to the fifth grade, I asked my mom, I said, can you let me go back to public school? Because I feel like I'm behind. And like, you know, you develop a voice as a kid, you start figuring out the stuff you need or what you think you need. And I kind of feel awkward when I be outside with my homies. Like, I'm inside all day and I don't know what's going on. And, you know, obviously school is the biggest thing in the world to a kid. It's where you learn all your social, you know, stuff. And I just said, well, Mom, I think I need to go back. And so when she threw me back in the mix in the public school, I was so far ahead of everybody. You know, I was like 3-4, you know, grade levels above my counterparts. And I was reading on a 12th grade, you know, reading level by the time I was 6th, 7th grade. So by the time I got to, you know, my senior year, I had already taken my SATs 2-3 times. You know, I had already, you know, did all the things necessary to be, you know, a college student. But I still lacked just the follow through of being bold enough to be proud of the fact that I was like smart, or that I, you know, was someone who cared a lot about my grades, because my environment was still, you know, surrounded by people who didn't care about academics. You know, I didn't have any friends who went to college. I was the first in my immediate family to go to college. You know, I had never even met anybody who went to college and like graduated and got a degree. As crazy as that sounds, like that was my reality. So never seeing a campus, never talking to anyone who has that experience, you don't know like the ins and outs. You don't even really know how to study. You know what I mean? You don't know how to do the things that you're going to eventually have to do. You can get in a false sense of reality where you feel like you're prepared even though you're not. So grades were important, but I think sometimes we put too much of an emphasis on just like getting really good grades, and we forget to teach the kids how to be like individuals who understand what this stuff actually translates to in the real world. You know what I mean? Because those classes and the stuff you're learning, you're probably not going to use that, but you are going to use the habits that you learned as you aspire to be great in those classes, if that makes sense, right?
Like, makes total sense. You want to come over and tell my kids that?
Anytime, man. Anytime.
That's the same conversation I have with them all the time. You know, they're like, why are we learning this? I'm never going to know it. I'm like, yeah, but you're going to learn how to learn. That's what you're learning.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was struggling in that area, but yes, the fact that I had a, you know, 3.9 or whatever GPA I had at the time, I had almost a perfect SAT score back when it was out of like 2400. I think I got like a 2190 as a sophomore, you know, and then I retook it and got a little bit better each time. You know, all that stuff opened up options. Like, I mean, we had mail coming in my junior year and I didn't even really know what that meant. Like, I had Arizona State, Ole Miss, University of Florida. I could go to Georgia State, Georgia Tech, UGA. You know, like I had options. I just chose Hofstra because I thought I could hoop. You know, like yep. I didn't even understand like, oh, you should be looking into these schools because these are actually going to lead you to doing what it is you know, are going to be doing one day, or what you could be doing one day. Like, I just was so focused on basketball, but you actually don't even qualify to, you know, have the chance to even sit in front of some, certain schools or a certain coach, even if you are a great basketball player, if your grades are bad. You know, like working with kids now, I've worked with a lot of kids back in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years who state of Georgia were all, you know, state or all whatever. And, you know, they took the JUCO route. Why? It wasn't because, you know, no one wanted them. They had to go there for a year or two to, you know, get their associates, you know, just to lift up their GPA and qualify, you know. And some didn't even go to college because their grades were so bad. They just got swept through the system, you know. So it's a sad thing, but I'm glad it went that way for me, you know, because I don't think I'd be as hungry as I am now, you know, if I didn't have it that way. If I maybe just got, you know, fed through the system like others, I wouldn't understand it.
Absolutely. I think that there's no question that when you think about the system and the way college recruiting works, if you have the grades and you take care of that part of it, and the other thing that kids don't always realize is that starts from the time you're in ninth grade, and those grades start mm-hmm. having an impact. And so often mm-hmm. you see kids who, by the time they're a junior and they start thinking about, well, maybe I want to play college sports, and now they got 2 years on their high school transcript that, you know, they got C's, D's, F's, whatever, and it just limits your options. And for you, that wasn't an issue. And I think that's a huge, huge benefit for any kid, any player who's out there listening, any parent who's out there listening. Crack down on the academics right away. Get that taken care of, sure. because it just opens up many more athletic options for you if you have sure. the grades. You just have way more colleges and way more places that you can choose from. We all know the more choices you have, the better option you're probably going to find that's going to fit you and what it is that you're all about. All right, the next thing I want to ask you from your journey is, you talked a few times about trying to develop your basketball IQ and the fact that mm-hmm. not having played high school basketball and just played street ball, worked on your own on your game, that the IQ piece of it is something that maybe was difficult to learn in terms of what it's like to play organized basketball as opposed to playing pickup basketball at the playground. So right. how did you go about learning and improving your IQ? Was it just a matter of being exposed to coaching and being a part of a program, or were you doing other things like you mentioned when you had started your business, going to clinics, watching tape? Just describe your process of what you think enabled you to eventually develop a much higher basketball IQ than you had when you left high school.
For sure. So this is a shout out, first of all, to all of the trainers out there and to all of the kids who have trainers first. I'm talking directly to them. As trainers, we don't realize that we create drill robots. And as players, we don't even know when a trainer is just like putting batteries and like the hardware necessary to become a drill robot in us. Like for me as a coach, I was a, you know, coach before I really became a real player. My kids, you know, for the hour, 2 hours, whatever, I was, you know, gifted with working with them for, they only experienced like, go to this cone, go to that cone, Euro step, layup, you know, like that was right. that was the totality of what we were doing, you know. And so we think we're teaching these kids how to play. We're teaching these kids how to drill. You know, we're teaching these kids how to do the move within this setting. You falling for the move, or you sliding and letting the kid cross over, you know, just, you know, so that they can get to the next spot and then do whatever you told them to do at the next step. That's not the game. And so, although I had the work ethic of, you know, whoever you want to call, like, I worked crazy hard, I didn't know where that stuff applied. So it was all like, you know, a blind man basically feeling his way around a room. You know, like, there was no real system to how I approached playing, practicing. I didn't know what to even do first. I didn't know the mindset of a player. So I think number one is the atmosphere has to be created. So, you know, once I got into a setting that was organized and here's why we work on these things in practice, I'm working with other people, you know, like up to my first couple of years in college, I had never worked out with, you know, more than two or three other people. You know what I mean? Like, just think about that. Like, I had shot jumpers in the gym, but other than that, I just played. So I never did like a pick and roll breakdown with a big, another guard on me, a big guard in the screener, and a shooter in the corner. Like, you know, with the defender playing help and tagging the role, man. I never did a breakdown like that, three on three, and then you just play live. Like, but when I got to college, that was the type of stuff we did for the last 30 minutes, the last hour. You know, so your learning curve, it steepens and it gets a lot more vast when, you know, you don't have that experience. It's hard for you to catch up to everybody else, you know, but then once you get pushed into that situation again and again and again, okay, now you can actually start thinking about what moves work here and setting up that pick and roll and what are your reads when you first come over the top of the screen, where's the screener's defender, and you know, is the roll man open or is he tagged? I can hit the shooter in the court. Like, now you start thinking on a much more elevated level. And if it's filmed, you can watch it again. And, you know, oh, man, I missed this. And then you add two other players on the weak side. And now you, okay, I can hit the weak side spot up. Or, man, he cut and I didn't hit him. Or, man, I drove into help and, you know, I didn't even know where my next pass was. Like, all of those things became open to me, you know, once I played. And I think, again, I'm talking to trainers and I'm talking to players who have trainers. If you're not using situations or the game to actually create workouts, then you're failing your players if you're a coach, or you're failing yourself and you're hindering your IQ if you're a player. Because as a player, it's your right to come into a workout and be educated, not by the trainer who's actually working with you now, but be educated before it starts and say, hey, here's what I do in games. Here's what I do based on what my coaches tell me to do. Can you put me in this? What do I do in this situation? This happened to me last game. And obviously, you know, if it's an elementary school kid, he's not going to be able to, you know, articulate it that much, but he might still say, hey, coach, I get scared when players play too close. What do I do when people pressure me? You know? And so now as a player within that area of my journey, man, I just started developing a lot more rapidly, and it didn't feel fast at the time because, you know, we're all impatient. We want to be great today, you know, but I was getting better, you know, and it was because I knew what to work on. So now in the summers, after the school year's over, I'm taking my playbook home, and my workouts are literally me getting shots from the spots in that play, you know, or me having to bring the ball up and I don't have any defense on me, but I know where traps actually come from now because I got trapped playing JUCO basketball. I turned it over. I didn't get the ball into the middle. I dribbled to the sideline. You know, like, all of those things now made sense. And then as I continued to coach and be a trainer, now my training became a lot more crisp. It became a lot more realistic, you know, and I think to build a basketball IQ, you can't drill it. You know, you have to immerse a player first into the game, and you can do that through a video, which is a simulation, so to speak. You can do that through an action, a breakdown, if it's one-on-one or two-on-two or three-on-three, four-on-four. You know, that's how they do it in Europe. And then, of course, if you can do it in a five-on-five setting where you're forcing the one team to play out of a certain action or a play, and then the defense is going to, you know, strategically try to break it, you know, and stop it, then now you got growth. But if you're not doing that, you're just a drill robot, or you're just working on a minute detail within the game. You know, like Kobe working on a turnaround jump shot. That's not IQ in itself, but it can become IQ if it's detailed to the point where he's picking it apart and when to use it, how to use it, blah, blah, blah. So I don't know. That's a tough question to answer. I hope what I'm saying makes sense, but I just feel like, you know, I always took the game, and the game told me that it was like a cheat sheet, the film or the experience from practice. I would write it down in journals. I would write it in notebooks. That literally gave me the blueprint to how to work and increase my IQ. If I got cussed out by Coach Tony, I literally would write down, like, even with the cuss words, like what he said to me. Like, I was, you know, dang it, Corey, you know, you're supposed to reverse pivot and reverse the ball. Like, I would write, Corey should have reverse pivoted, and, you know, like, I kept a running journal of my F-ups, you know what I mean, and my successes as well. So there aren't enough players today, or maybe there's not enough coaches who are telling players the truth. And it's, you don't really need us. You know, my job is a luxury. You know, I'm just being real. Like, the five players on the floor don't really need a skill coach. Think how long the game has been in existence, right? And skill training or skill coaches are the newest addition to the game. The rules haven't changed very much. The lines, the parameters of the court haven't changed very much. You know, the shot clock has been around for, you know, a good while now. We're not shooting four-pointers or five-pointers yet. There's nothing really new about the game. But you add in this additional coach, teacher, whatever you want to call it, and now we're the ones who seem to be the wisest. We have the most information. We're the smartest. How does that work? We're the newest, you know? So we should be going to the game to get our information and then just reflecting that to the players. But we want it to be this thing that's self-serving sometimes. So we're only drawing from what we believe or our philosophy, or this is what I think. Man, it's not about what you think. It's what does the game say? You know what I'm saying? The game has been here and it'll be here even after I'm gone. So let that teach the player, you know, and put it in a way where they can understand it and chew on it and digest it. But, you know, if we're not doing that, we're doing a disservice. Just trying to be creative. Like, I don't know.
No, that makes a ton of sense. I want to pull out a couple things that you said there. One is, I love how you talked about having the player come with an idea of what it is that they want to learn, what it is that they actually do in a game, and then going to their trainer and saying, hey, I need to work on this because this is what I do within the confines of my team structure. And to me, that's something that a lot of times is lost in the training business, where you just have a trainer who's working on, okay, I have this generalized workout and I do this workout with every single player that comes through the door. And I think the really good trainers are the ones who, A, are always working on their craft and trying to get better and learning the game so that they understand lots of different situations, so that when a player comes to them, they can develop that situation, be able to give their players an opportunity to get involved in that particular action. And then I think the second thing is that if a kid doesn't come to you or a parent doesn't come to you with an idea of these are the things that we want to work on because we're doing this, then to me, that's the trainer's job to go to that player, to go to that parent, right, to go to their high school coach or whoever it is that's coaching them during their season and say, what does this player need to work on? Where do they get the ball? What are the things that they do? And I think if you do that, then, as you've said, you're actually serving the needs of your players, which is really what it's all about. And then the other thing that I thought about when you were talking about Kobe breaking down and working on his turnaround jump shot, and you talked about how that's not working on basketball IQ, but it can become working on basketball IQ. And I think what I thought of when you said that was that you have to develop a skill in order to be able to perform it in the game. You have to have the ability to just, let's keep it simple, you have to be able to shoot it. You have to be able to shoot a jump shot, but there's so much more that goes into that in a game other than just standing in front of a shooting machine and shooting 200 shots in a row from the same spot. You have to go and you have to move and you have to figure out, make a decision. Should I shoot? How do I get open to get my shot? What kind of footwork do I need when I'm moving left, when I'm moving right, when I'm moving forward, when I'm coming off a screen, whatever it is. And so I think basketball is such a decision-making sport that too often what we do is we focus on the skill and we forget the decision. And I almost think, and tell me what your thought is on this, I almost think that it's easier to overcome the lack of skill by being a good decision maker, whereas you can have a ton of skill, but if you don't have the ability to make a good decision and you don't have a basketball IQ, it's almost impossible to get you out on the floor. But if you're lacking in skill, but you have some IQ, I think that's probably a better combination. Obviously you put them both together and that's really what you want. But I just think basketball is such a decision-making skill. And we oftentimes as trainers, and I think coaches at all levels, sometimes forget that it's a decision-making skill. And when you teach the players how to make decisions, and you give them room to make decisions and then evaluate those decisions, that's when you really see improvement in a player's game.
No, that, I agree with you 100%, Mike. That's the best way you can put it. But do most of us know early on in our coaching careers or, you know, training careers, do we really know how to create decision-making situations and drills? Probably not.
Probably not.
You know what I mean? We're still learning the ability to break down just the skills and the foundations of maybe a move, you know, like a right to left crossover or whatever. So because we're so hyper focused on just the ability to break it down and be, you know, very professional sounding when we speak and articulate, you know, then we just give ourselves a pat on the back once we get to that mountaintop, that point of being able to just, you know, teach it. But now the greatest, you know, like you said, the greatest level of being able to teach it is actually showing the player when to use it. Like that kid that's on that shooting machine, when do you shoot? When do you shot fake and drive? When do you swing it one more to the guy who's even more open than you? That's something that we have to aspire to. You know, that has to be at the forefront. And it needs to be purposeful. Like, you need to get in the gym and with every single skill that you touch on that day, at least finish it for 2-3 minutes at the end of maybe that 5-minute segment, 10-minute segment with something that forces that player to do decision making, make a decision. Like this morning, I worked with a rookie point guard on our team. He has a Chinese name that's hard for people to remember, but I'll just call him by his American name, which is Drake. So he's not playing a lot. He struggles sometimes in practice. And so practices are like his games. Puts a lot of pressure on himself. Yesterday, he had a so-so practice. The day before, he got killed. You know, so it's a dog-eat-dog league, you know, when you play in the pros. And this is the time of year when we have draft prospects come and work out. So this is critical for him, you know, to play well against someone that's literally coming in to take his job next year, if you think about it. So he's frustrated. He wants to know how to get better. And he's super hungry. So we get in the gym every morning at 8:15 like we did today, and we're working, and we're just talking about bringing the ball up against pressure, you know, initiating the offense, getting the ball to the high post because we play out of the pinch post. He struggles with that. So, of course, I'm teaching him how to dribble from a closed stance, how to attack the defender's hips to get the ball across half court, where to stop, what angles to try to get that initiating pass, you know, thrown to the high post from. And it's easy to see that he's picking it up, but there's no pressure. There's no decisions. So what do? Before we even move on, before we stop and go to a water break, for 2 minutes, now he has to decide on a C cut for the inbounds pass, which way is he going to fake and then which way is he going to loop in to get the ball based on how I guard him or based on, you know, what I call using my voice as the defense. Then he's got to decide which way to go with his dribble once he puts the ball down. He's got to decide on how to get the ball to the high post based on where the defense is denying or playing behind the high post. Like, those are simple things. But, man, for 5-6 years of my training career, I failed my players because I just consciously did not approach training or practices or teaching like that. And as a player, I was failing because I didn't know how to even do that in my own workout. You know what I mean? I didn't have an imagination. I just brainlessly, mindlessly worked on a move or – shot jumpers, you know. So I apologize for being long-winded, but I feel like that's the real topic that a lot of coaches need to focus on. It's not so much like, man, I need a new drill. No, you just need a new way to take that old drill you got and force the players to make decisions out of it, you know.
That's so true. And I think that there's ways that you can take the things that you've been doing if you're a, quote, traditional coach and mm-hmm. be able to put those things into more of a games-based approach, more of a situational approach, more of a decision-making approach just by – it could be, let's say it's a one-on-one workout, just by adding yourself into the workout and making yep. sure that your player has to make a decision based on the way you line up as a defender or how you play them yep. coming off a screen or whatever it may be. And then obviously you can take it to the next level if you're – having a multiple player workout, and you can go one-on-one with the two players, or you can go two-on-two if you yep. have that. And
yep.
that just provides so many more opportunities than just having, let's say you have a three-person workout where those three players are just all working on the same skill, but never really going against each other, being put into situations. And I think that's one of the things, Corey, that what I've seen over the course of time is that you see a lot more people. There's still not everybody. There's still, I think, a lack of tons of coaches that are doing it. But I think you're starting to see a shift both from a skills trainer point of view, but also from a high school, college point of view, where coaches are starting to understand that when you're coaching your team, it's important to be able to put them into situations and not just work on skills in isolation like we talked about earlier. And that's really how you begin to see improvement. And yet at the same time, I think one of the things that you often, I don't know if I hear coaches complain about it or worry about it, but I think it's easier to run what looks like an organized training session or an organized practice by having lines and having our kids do the same thing over and over again. Oh, look at how good they are at this crossover dribble, as opposed to having them play 3-on-3 where it looks like, hey, boy, this looks disorganized. And man, those kids can get the ball off their foot. And so I think that sometimes there's a perception issue with coaches when it comes to maybe their hesitation to incorporate some of the things that we're talking about.
That's right. That's right. I agree.
All right. So let me ask you this. I want to talk briefly about, once your playing career is over, how do you restart your training business, what that looks like for you. And then after we talk about that, let's talk a little bit about how the opportunity to go over and work with the Royal Fighters in China, how that came to be.
So in the summers, you know, between my college basketball seasons, I always maintained, you know, my client base in Atlanta, Georgia. I always looked to, you know, meet up with my mentor who actually connected us two together, Gannon Baker. You know, I would go down to Florida and sit in on some of his lectures or be a part of his coaching clinics or his NBA pre-draft stuff. So I was never really detached from my business. You know, student of the game, it's always been running, you know, for the past 11, 12 years now. And, you know, I tried to even sort of morph it as I was playing, where while I was gone for, you know, the fall, the winter, and the spring times, you know, in each year, I would do more online or virtual work with players. I never really got into the virtual training, so to speak, of like videoing myself and, or doing like live stuff. You know, I wish I could, but I was just so focused on my playing career that I didn't feel like I had the energy to, you know, take that much time away from working out and focusing as a student. But I definitely did, you know, player analysis, breaking down footage, you know, evaluating film, you know, sending them back, you know, the things that I saw that were either strengths or weaknesses, you know, trying to help players get recruited, you know. So those things, they continued to be a source of connection between me and the players. Once I got to my senior year, I actually was given the opportunity to leave school early and go potentially play in the Philippines. Gannon called me one day just in the middle of, I think it was first semester before we even reached the halfway point. He said, you know, there was just an opportunity that I could be like a player coach, or so to speak. And one of the leagues, I don't know if it was the PBA or if it was a lower league in the Philippines, but, you know, it was paying. And it was a real, like, crossroads for me. I had to try to, you know, calm myself and figure out, like, what was best in that moment. And was this immediately going to deter me from the things that I wanted to do in my future, which was, you know, become a coach one day in the NBA, or was this going to lead me towards that? And so I kind of felt, you know, at that point with my age, you know, just of, you know, it took me so long to get back into school, and I finally developed that consistency and just the humility to approach every single day like it was a blessing, you know, as a student again. I couldn't just derail, you know, my senior year and kind of leave my teammates hanging, as well as, you know, not finish and get my degree. So I told them no. And once I got my degree, you know, everything was cool. But now I had to make a choice as to where to go next. I had the opportunity to take some grad assistant jobs, as well as some head assistant jobs with various colleges around the country, just from working relationships. But again, I thought about, does this lead me ultimately, you know, towards my goal? And they seemingly would have. I'm not going to shoot them down or, you know, be disrespectful and say that a college coaching job wouldn't have, but I just didn't have a gut feeling about, you know, pursuing any of the stuff that was on the table at that point. So Gannon actually came back around and told me about the opportunity to, you know, take 12 months to travel to China and do coaching clinics. And so that felt a little bit more flexible to me, like, hey, here's, you know, an opportunity for just 1 year of your young life to go and experience another culture, work within the game, create different relationships, learn more, as well as, you know, impact an entire basketball community that is somewhat still untouched. You know, it's very raw in its nature. So, you know, I talked with my peoples about it for a little bit, and I prayed over it, and I made the decision that I was going to pursue it. So, you know, I've been in China now since 2018. And when I originally came, I wasn't, you know, working with a professional organization. You know, I wasn't with the CBA. I was actually working with children, you know, every day. And it was a little bit humbling in the way of, it made me feel like I had taken a step backwards. You know, I'm not saying that they lied to me before I came here, but they definitely didn't. They didn't paint the picture of me working with babies. You know, people, kids who've never even touched a basketball, seen a basketball.
Understood.
You know, I was doing classes outside with no rim, no court, like, you know, on turf, or I'd be outside, you know, on the sidewalk, you know, outside of the schoolhouse, you know, with 6 year olds. And it was more of just like being a glorified PE coach. Like, I would just come in and work for an hour or 2 hours and then just go home or go back to the office where our training business, you know, was headquartered at. And so I had a lot of time, you know, to like think to myself, like, why am I here? Like, what is my purpose? Did I miss the mark on this one? Did I make a bad choice? You know, I could be working with, you know, Division I girls, or I could be working with, you know, guys, or blah, blah, blah. And I just made the decision ultimately, like, you know what? These kids may not be LeBron James or, you know, Giannis or James Harden, but I'm going to treat them like NBA All-Star. And so after about a month or two of feeling sorry for myself, I just kind of put on my hard hat and went to work every single day. Like, it was my opportunity. It was my interview. It was my, you know, tryout all over again. And, you know, the parents, they loved it. Everyone who would see the workouts or the practices began to, you know, fall in love with the energy created. My other Chinese counterparts and coworkers, you know, we developed a bond, and, you know, the upper management ownership of the company, they loved, you know, how I was approaching, you know, each opportunity to work. You know, I was on time or early every day, stayed late, you know, tried to immerse myself in the culture, learn the language, you know, even got a Chinese name, Bao Zhong, you know, so that was a whole thing, you know. And when the time came to re-sign my contract, you know, although I was willing to serve, I wasn't willing to be taken advantage of, you know. So it was the first time I ever sat in a boardroom in a meeting and been asked, like, what do you think you deserve? You know, what do you want? You know, what are you worth? And so I took that opportunity to bet on myself. And, you know, I told them, this is what I'm worth. This is what I want. When they couldn't meet my terms, you know, of course, we continued to go back and forth. But I stood my ground, and they didn't meet that. So I said no. And long story short, I met Stephon Marbury through the work I was doing here. I had never met him before in my life. This wasn't like some favor, you know, or anything of him just kind of doing me a solid because we're boys or something like that. Like, I had no idea he was a shareholder with the training company. And so he just popped in on a weekend skill session we had with some middle school kids. And, you know, his name was on the thing, and I was just as shocked as they were. You know, so he comes in and he kind of takes over. And Mike, I tell you, man, this is the truth. We were not cool, like, on first glance. Like, I was in the middle of a session doing my thing, and the kids were learning, and we were rocking out and everything. And then he comes in and he just blows it up, and he, like, takes over. And, you know, as a coach, if you're in the middle of a practice or a training session, that's kind of like your baby.
That's it. That's, you know, yours.
Yeah, it's yours. And that energy you got going, it's very it means a lot to you. You know, and for someone to come in and just break that, it doesn't really matter who they are. It's like, yo, like, that feels a little disrespectful. But he wasn't doing it on purpose. He's the Michael Jordan of China. So, you know, there's a way that things kind of go when he comes around. So he came in and everything stopped. And then it was like, he just threw it back to me, like, all right, go. Like, he talked to kids for 10 minutes, but then just said, all right, go back to what you were doing. And I'm like, okay. Like, it took me 20 minutes just to kind of get them like understanding. And now you want me to just like get it going again? Like, I'm not a magician, but of course all those are things in my head. I'm not saying that out loud, but I try to get them going again, and he sees it. And just like you said, it was a little chaotic. They weren't looking as organized as they were when he first walked in. So what do you think he did? He said, all right, let's cut that. Like, that's dead. All right, here's what we're going to do. And then for the next hour, he ran the show. And so it was a shot to my pride, but I didn't let it make me bitter. You know, of course, I still was respectful to him. And, you know, whenever he came around, I was gracious, but I wasn't going to be his groupie. You know what I'm saying? I was just there to work. So we didn't really develop like a huge bond. It wasn't like we talked and we did this and we did that. It actually came to a day where he gained a little respect for me while he was teaching and he was leading. And I could tell he had a lot of things going on. He was probably tired that day. And he said, Corey, put them through such and such. Like, he wanted me to teach them, I think, how to shoot, like proper form, proper technique. And so I maybe had 40 kids, you know, and I had to teach them all how to shoot at the same time. And so, you know, I got them going into a pretty much progressive, you know, shooting drill, but yet we're not even shooting. We're just working on where our feet are, our stance, the ball position, blah, blah, blah. And you know what he did, Mike? He sat down. That was the first time he had ever sat down in front of me and just watched. And even now, you know, I work for him. He's our head coach, you know, and I'm on the staff. He doesn't sit down in games. So for him to sit down, that's a big deal if you really know him. You know what I mean? He's a very intense person. He's a very focused person. He has a lot of drive and ambition. So he's whatever he's doing, he's going 100 miles an hour as he's doing it. So for him to sit down that day and just be locked in on what we were doing, what I was teaching, my words, and then he only supported, he only chimed in to like reinforce, that was kind of like a big deal to me that day. And it was like, okay, he trusts me now. And so after that, then I was asked to go and do more camps and travel around China and do events with him. And, you know, I would do all the teaching and, you know, he would just sometimes make appearances and just kind of add on. And this job opportunity came about through a relationship with his agent. It wasn't even him. He wanted to hire someone else and things just didn't work out with the other guy. And I had already came in, tried to assist with practices, but basically I was told I couldn't get the job. So I went and I tried out for another CBA team for 21 days. My interview was a month long. And, you know, it was like a big deal, like a secret thing. I couldn't talk about the fact that I knew Marbury because he was a enemy, you know, to that right. Head coach because, you know, he had beat them in the finals. And, you know, everyone hates Marbury in certain parts of China. So, you know, I had to be very secretive and they found out. And so even though I crushed the month, they sent all the other trainers home who I was competing against in like this interview process. And I was the last man standing. I still didn't get the job because they found out. And, so I went back to the States feeling like, you know, man, that was fun, but you know, it's pretty much over. And I think I had been home for maybe 12 days. Marbury called me at 3 a.m. And, you know, he was just like, yo, you awake? And I'm like, yeah, I'm up. You know, I'm up now. Like, it's all good. And, you know, he had never called me before that. But, you know, he just hit me up and he said, look, this is what happened. I'm sorry that we didn't really like explain to you the situation. The other guy, he's just not the type of guy we want. And you know what? You're just a good person, man. Like, I trust you. You got a professional demeanor, you know, and I want somebody like you on our staff. And then that was all she wrote. The next day I was on a plane. I was expecting to really get a break, like get a rest because I had lived in China for a whole year. I didn't see my family or anyone. You know, I didn't go back to the States, but man, am I going to miss this? Like, am I going to, you know, like let this bus pass me by? You know, heck no. So it's been on and popping since then. And man, it's crazy how your life can change in a year or two. You know,
absolutely,
like
man.
I was sleeping in an apartment with no mattress, bad plumbing, took the bus every day, took the subway, changed clothes every time I got to work because I would sweat out my clothes, you know, trying to pinch pennies together to get noodles at the local place. And, you know, now I'm okay. So that's just, you know, it's another step in the journey, right? As a player, it's the same thing. And now as a coach, it's kind of the same thing. So I'm blessed.
Absolutely. There's a great lesson in what you said, and I'm going to try to summarize it. And it's something that we've heard as a theme throughout our podcast. And actually, the first person who was a guest on our show that I heard say this was Don Showalter, who works with USA Basketball. He's a 10-time gold medalist with the under-18 junior national team of the United States. And what Coach Showalter said was that people would come up to him and say, "Coach, how do I get the opportunity to work with USA Basketball and be able to coach some of the best players all across the country? What did you do? How can I get to where you are today?" And his advice, which echoes completely the story that you just told, which is his advice was, you have to be great at the job that you are in right now. And that job might be coaching a high school varsity team. It might be being an NBA coach, or it might be, like you, coaching 7-year-olds in China.
Yep.
But yep. You have to do the best job that you can. And when you were talking and you said, I just made a decision that I was going to go out and imagine I was working with NBA players, and that's how hard I was going to work. And if you do that, somebody's going to notice. And you had no idea that Stephon Marbury was going to show up one day in your gym and see you doing that, and that then that was going to lead to the next opportunity. You had no idea. And yet what you did was every day you just put on your hard hat and went to work and did the things that you're supposed to do. And then as a result of that, the next opportunity comes. And I think for anybody, that could be for a player, that could be for a coach, that could just be for any person in general, there's a great lesson to be learned there that you have to do the best job wherever you are right now. And if you do, one, you're going to get more satisfaction out of what you're doing, but two, you're going to get another opportunity because somebody somewhere is going to notice that hard work and knowing what you're doing, and it's going to open another door for you. And I think your story from the time you were a little kid up until what you're doing now, that's kind of the theme that runs through your entire journey, is you just keep working and doing your best in the moment where you are, and boom, all of a sudden the next door opens and the next door opens and the next door opens. And eventually you find yourself looking at an opportunity that, again, if we would have asked Corey 10 years ago, hey, what do you think you're going to be doing in 10 years? The odds of you coming up with what you're doing today would have been, you know, astronomical against you ever figuring that out. But yet here you are. It's just an amazing story.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
All right. So I want to ask you, we're coming up on close to an hour and a half. So I want to give you an opportunity to share where people can find out more about you and all the things you're doing. But I want to ask you one more question before I do that. What's your day to day like as the skills trainer for the fighting, for the Royal Fighters? What is day to day? What are you doing in practice with guys?
So as of right now, you know, it's a weird time, you know, with the pandemic, but we're blessed to still be rolling. You know, the CBA, like the NBA as well, is trying to figure out a restart date. And as of now, it's slated to start sometime in mid-June. I think June 16th was the last date we were given. So at this point, we practice 3 times a week, but I'm basically on call 7 days a week. You know, anyone who's been around, you know, the professional game knows if you're a skill coach or an assistant coach, especially a young assistant coach, you know, your job is to put the players first. So like today, I wake up, you know, around 6:30 in the morning, Beijing time here. That's 6:30 p.m., you know, for you guys on the East Coast. And I'm immediately trying to just take time for myself. You know, I want to be the best version of myself that I can to help them. So I got to read, you know, I got to get quiet. I got to pray or listen to some music, or even just make a call, you know, talk to somebody that can kind of fill that tank up, you know, to give me a little bit of juice for the rest of the day. Around 8:15, I'm going downstairs. We live on a compound that shares a hotel, a nice cafeteria, like kind of a mess hall. And then next to that is a like four-level weight training facility. And then on the opposite side of that building is, you know, our sports complex that has all the gyms and everything. So this is a really, really nice setup right here. And it's a dope place to be quarantined because it's all in one. But so, you know, at 8:15, I'm going downstairs, going next door to the mess hall, meeting, you know, the rookie point guard, Drake, who I told you about before. you know, we're eating breakfast, and then we're leaving from there, you know, within a couple minutes to go next door to get in the weight room. Today's a Thursday, so he actually has a late lift with our strength coach around 2. So I don't want to double up with him on Thursday. We do, like, yoga, some stretching, you know, things that are going to just keep him, you know, at an optimum level. But if it was a Monday or Wednesday or Friday, we would go pretty hard in the weight room together because he just wants to lift. He just wants it that bad. So I try to stay in shape on my own, and he kind of, you know, just follows me around. And, you know, so I say, hey, man, like, let's just stretch. So after that, probably around 9 o'clock, we're hitting the gym. We're doing skill work. Since he has that late lift, he would go at 9, but usually I work with our star point guard, Kyle Fault, who's a foreign player. He played at the University of Arizona. He's done some stuff with the G League as well as USA Basketball recently. But, you know, he wants to go before weight, so I let Drake go early. And, you know, we're doing skill work. Another player might come in right after him at 10, but I'm out of the gym around, like, 11:30. And that's our day, you know, as far as in the morning. And I see a few more players in the PM, you know, like, after they take a nap. In China, it's custom for them to eat lunch and then go to sleep for an hour, eat lunch and go to sleep for maybe 2 hours. I mean, it's crazy, Mike. Like, even when I was, you know, in the office, when I was working, you know, before I got this job, my coworkers would come to work with, you know, neck pillows, and they would sleep on their desk. So it kind of threw me off, you know, my first couple of weeks. Like, I just thought, man, y'all are the laziest mofos I've ever met. And then I realized, like, everybody's doing that. Like, it's not just my coworkers. That's China.
Right.
So, you know, you got to assimilate yourself into the culture and, you know, be flexible. And, you know, I give those guys their time, and then I'm in the gym once they're ready, you know, and they're done with that. But on an average practice day, like a day like yesterday, it's the same start. But, of course, you know, we have to be in the gym a little bit earlier. So practice starts at 3:30. I'm in there at 2:45 to do, like, some more skill work, some more pre-practice stuff out of our actions with, you know, 2 or 3 of our rotational guys that they know they're going to get shots from certain spots. So I break down their film. I send them evaluations from, like, maybe the last 8 games. We haven't played in a while, so, you know, we're still kind of chewing on stuff from January. But, you know, they're just working away at that. And once practice gets started, you know, now I'm more of a role player. I'm the background singer, right? I'm playing the drums. So, you know, whatever Steph says, whatever Coach Jay says, Jay Humphreys, our head assistant, that's what goes. And so, you know, I jump in drills if they need an extra body. If they don't, I'm just kind of pulling guys to the side, maybe correcting if I see something, or I'm just being supportive. I'm being a cheerleader. You know, there's no pride in being a young assistant coach. Like, you got to be willing to do the stuff no one else wants to do. And, you know, you also have to create sometimes a role for yourself. So for me, like, I like diagramming plays. I don't know why, but I really like doing that. So anytime we install something new, I'm on the iPad, or I got a spare sheet of paper, and I'm diagramming it so that I can get back to my room later that evening and then put it on fast draw so that Coach Steph can have it, so that the players can have it, you know, at any time. Maybe I'm asking the film guy to film the scrimmage because I want to doctor that film. I want to edit that film the next time I work with our starting point guard. Like, today I'm going to work with him 12:45, and we're just going to work on his shooting, and then we're going to work on his turnaround jumpers. Because in our offense now, he can post guys up, and he's big and strong. So, you know, he's watching The Last Dance. He's watching Kobe tapes. He's watching film of himself from yesterday when he got put in 2 situations. You know, so that's all a part of not someone necessarily telling me what to do. It's just, hey, I want to make sure that I'm an asset and I'm adding value, you know. So it's a lot of days of not necessarily being told thank you or being appreciated or someone publicly, like, you know, crowning you or something like that in front of everyone. But you get a good feeling when you see the players doing this stuff in games that they've been working with you on. And so that's pretty dope to me. But my free time is usually, you know, at night once things get settled, you know, after dinner, that's when I can kind of, you know, decompress. And but, you know, I'm a grinder, so I just find something else to busy myself.
Exactly.
But so
I understand.
That's my day, man.
I got it, man. It's like a basketball junkie's dream over there. All right, before we get out, I want to give you an opportunity to share where people can follow you, where they can find out more about you, share your social media, share your website, just ways that people can connect with you, and then I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Sure, sure. So anyone who's listening, you can find me on Instagram. It's just my name, KoreyHarris, no space, so at Corey Harris. My Twitter is exactly the same. I do have a website as well, CoreyHarris.org, so it's all pretty universal, easy to find me. Trust me, I am not egotistical. I mean, I don't want my name up in lights or anything like that. It's not why everything is named that, but it's easy to find that way, I think. So I also have a couple books that I've self-published on Amazon. One is just a cool, inspirational book, a little bit about my own personal journey, but more so just to inspire whoever is reading. It's called Leading While Being Led. And again, you can find that on Amazon, Leading While Being Led. And I also have a drill book that I published some years ago called Student of the Game. So if you go on Amazon and you just type in my name, those two works will come up. But you can contact me on social media. I'm over here in China, so phone numbers are a little hard to use. Email is good as well. SOGTrainingCo@gmail.com. That stands for Student of the Game. So SOGTrainingCo@gmail.com. That's my business email.
Perfect. Corey, we're going to put all that in the show notes so people who are listening can copy that down and reach out to you if they have a question or they want to get involved with you when you're back here in the States. They can follow your career. Your story that you shared with us tonight was inspiring in so many different ways, and I think there was a ton of great lessons that players, coaches can pull out of there, whether you're trying to figure out how to be the best player you can be or whether you're trying to figure out how do I go about getting my coaching career off the ground and getting started. There's a lot of great lessons that you shared with us tonight. Can't thank you enough for spending, I don't know, an hour and a half or so with us. Really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.